Okay, I would like to introduce today's presenter. Osley Biljan is a developer evangelist for the Microsoft Corporation. And again, the title of today's MSDN webcast is Migrating from Classic ASP to ASP.NET 2.0. Again, it's the first part of a two-part series. Osley, you now have the floor.
Thank you, Jeff. My name is Osley Biljan. I'm part of the National Architecture Team at Microsoft, serving as a developer evangelist. Today we're going to be covering part one of a two-part series. The second part will be on Monday, so stay tuned. For those of you that are unable to catch either part one or part two, they're both are going to be recorded and available on demand, as Jeff indicated. Also, just a couple other things to add housekeeping-wise is if you, instead of taking notes, if you'd like, you can go ahead and download this presentation to PDF using your file menu on the screen right now. And also, as Jeff indicated, you can use your Q&A panel on your bottom right-hand part of your screen to ask questions throughout the presentations. I'm going to reserve answering them until the end. What I would ask you, though, is feel free to ask them throughout the presentation so that we have a queue built up by the time I get to the end. If you could, keep your questions pretty succinct and short so that I can read them on air very quickly and answer them live for you. For those of you that have questions that are a bit longer, my email address is posted right here. I'm happy to take any discussions offline with you. So moving ahead, just review what we're going to be covering in this two-part series. Sections 1 and 2 with Ready and Set is what we'll cover in part 1. So the whole layout of both sessions are Ready, Set, Go in terms of what do you need to do to decide how you're going to migrate? How do you identify the components you do want to migrate? Set being analyzing your current project and system and getting ready to do the actual migrations. These are both part of the design process. That's what we'll cover today. The last part, which is quite substantial and we've dedicated an entire session for, is the Go part, the actual implementation. That's where you're going to see the code, the actual code references that you need to be aware of. I'll provide you with tips and tricks so you're aware of any tips and tricks that you need to be tuned into for ASP 2.0, as well as give you specific scenarios and usage situations that you may run into that we've seen our customers run into so that you can avoid those traps for yourself. So that being said, one other thing I'll tell you up front for those of you that are completely new to .NET is that ASP and ASP.NET are two completely different things. They have ASP in the title, and that's pretty much the only similarity. In fact, a lot of times when I'm doing interviews, if I see on someone's resume in the language section, if I see ASP.NET, I tend to smile because ASP.NET is not a language. ASP was considered one. ASP.NET, you can use any of the .NET languages such as VB.NET, C#, etc. to write ASP.NET code. What ASP.NET really means is it's a way of doing web development using Microsoft technologies with .NET. So, because of that, because they're two different things, talking about a migration, how does that affect us? Well, if they are two different things, it's dismayingly mundane to show demonstrations of me taking original ASP code and bringing it up to ASP.NET. It's because they're two different things. There are tools that I will discuss in the sessions that help you get there, to get to ASP.NET. But the biggest challenge overall that I can tell you up front is the fact that they are two different worlds. Although there are tools for that, you really need to do a lot of due diligence up front. That's why we have an entire session about due diligence and design in part one. So that also being said, we will not be covering demonstrations in this session, again, because I want to avoid having you just sit there and watch me do a glorified find and replace, and instead spend that time and dedicate that time to actual tips and tricks and practical considerations. The tools are fairly self-explanatory. I'll be sure to cover them in detail to get you going, and running them, it's a no-brainer. So we won't be covering the demonstrations. What I will be providing, especially in part two, is actual code samples. So I will provide you code samples about what the code looks like in ASP and what it should look like in ASP.NET. And it's up to you whether you want to use a tool to get you there or if you want to actually make those code changes by hand. So just setting those assumptions up front. Now that we understand what we're going to be covering in the two parts, let's understand what we're going to be covering specifically in this hour. what I'm going to do first is talk about different ideas that you can think about for doing your migration. There, I understand completely situations where you don't have enough time or budget, and you can't necessarily do the whole entire migration, and you have to think about doing something more tactical, such as migrating only maybe the user interface or migrating only a certain subset of the system. So I'll talk about the different analyses that you can do to determine whether you're better suited for a tactical or strategic approach. Once I identify all those different types of strategies, what I'll do is I'll drill down into each of those and give you pros and cons, so things that you should be aware of before you even write a line of code. And then lastly, at the very end, I'm going to give you tips and tricks on what you can do today, right now, to get started, even without even installing ASP 2.0, things you can do to your existing classic ASP code to get started. Another thing that I'm going to do throughout the presentation on both days is make sure that I'm also considering people that are working with ASP.NET 1.1. So I will have references to those. This session will be relevant to you, to those of you that are working with 1.1 and are not ready yet to do 2.0. So be aware that it's going to be applicable to both of you. For the situations where it's ASP 2.0 only, I'll be sure to point that out in the material. So let's go ahead and begin with our first part, which is the ready, determining your migration plan. So what do you need to do in order to determine your migration plan? First, you'll have to identify what kind of choices that you have in store for you. First of all, you'll have to just look at your existing system. A lot of the whole fact that it's called a migration means that there's existing code. If there's existing code, you don't want to throw it away. You might want to actually work with some of it and leverage your existing code base and determine an integration plan. ASP.NET 2.0 is fully suited for integrating with your existing code, whether it's classic ASP, whether it's VB6 DLLs, whether it's ASP.NET 1.1. They all can run side by side alongside of each other. That being said, there are certain considerations in terms of interoperability for the different systems and different technologies to communicate with one another. I'll be covering all of those pointers in part two. So if you do decide to do side-by-side execution, keep in mind in session two, I'm going to actually be covering gotchas that you need to be concerned about. But know that they can install side-by-side, they can run side-by-side alongside one another, and you can certainly have a heterogeneous system, a mix of classic ASP and ASP.NET. Other things that I'm going to be drilling into is determining your development migration strategy. The way we can look at this is looking at it horizontal versus vertical. Horizontal being the three classic tiers, user, business, data. So you can look at your migration in terms of, let me just migrate the ASP front end only to ASP.NET. You could think of it as a vertical. So let me migrate a subsystem. Migrate over my reporting system, my subsystem. And that would be vertical, meaning it touches one or many horizontal layers. I'll drill down into that a little deeper with some graphics to show you what I mean. And then I also want to weigh the differences between migration versus interoperability and specifically pay attention to COM interoperability. For those of you unfamiliar with what that is, it means that you can actually leverage existing COM components. Most of the time in classic ASP, you're going to be using COM components, whether they're written in C++ or VB6, and use them and consume them from your ASP pages. There's no reason why you have to just throw them all away or upgrade them all to .NET. You can still use those COM components with ASP.NET 2.0. And today I'll show you how. And then lastly, what we'll do, once we determine and identify the different strategies you can take, I'll give you some tips about what you can do to analyze your system so you can determine what the best strategy for you would be. And finally, at the end of the day, once we get through all this, what we'll do is set the stage for part two. So you'll have the weekend to think about what you want to do in terms of your migration strategy, and then come Monday, we'll talk about implementation and actually putting that into effect with writing the code. So let's begin with legacy integration. As I indicated, you can do side-by-side and run ASP alongside ASP.NET. You can run them both on the same box. I can have one IIS server supporting both ASP and ASP.NET. I can have also many different flavors of ASP.NET. I could have 1.0, 1.1, and 2.0 all running side by side. The reason why I can do this is that they all use separate ISAPI filters to render the page logic, and they exist as completely separate applications. So I can have them on my box, and I can have one site as an ASP site, another site as an ASP.NET site. I can take that one step further, and I can actually have those communicate with one another and have common components shared between ASP.NET and ASP and have them communicate. In part two, I'm going to be covering exactly different code changes that you'll have to make in order to enable this to happen flawlessly and smoothly. But architecturally, this is fully supported between ASP and ASP.NET. And then lastly, in terms of legacy integration, if you choose not to do side-by-side or integration, you can do a rewrite. Take all your code, your classic ASP code, and move it up to the ASP.NET. And I put this as a final option because a lot of times people think that this is their only choice. They think, okay, well, if I want to take my ASP site, the only choice I really have is to move it all wholesale to ASP.NET. And that's not necessarily the case, and it's not always appropriate either. So in terms of side-by-side execution, another thing that I'll point out to you that I get as a question developers ask me, they say, well, you know my ASP page, can I just take my ASP page and just put an X on the end of it and then it'll run just fine in ASP.NET? The answer is no. An ASP page is not an ASPX page. They're completely two different animals, and just by changing the extension doesn't make the ISAPI filter pick it up. The biggest difference that I can tell you, and this is something no tool is going to be able to help you with, is the fact that ASP does not have early binding. So your variables that you declare in ASP, the interpreter has no idea whether that's an integer or whether that's a string or whether that's a custom class that you came up with. Because of that, even a tool that goes through and tries to move your code from ASP to ASP.NET is not going to be able to determine, well, wait a minute, here's this int, my int. Okay, so should I take that variable and make that an integer just because it's called my int? Or should I make it a string, or how do I know what that is? The tool's not going to know. So your biggest challenge, even as a human, not even using a tool, is being able to look at someone's old ASP code and figure out what those data types are. So something you can do today and encourage your development teams to do today, if they're still writing ASP code, is to put comments right next to each declaration and dimension statement to indicate what type of data type that is, so that when it comes time to migrate to ASP.NET, you're prepared and you're ready for that. The other consideration with side-by-side, besides just trying to rename the file, is the fact that in terms of having them communicate with one another, there are a few things that can't be shared because they're using two different object models. ASP session and ASP application object is different than ASP.NET session and ASP.NET application object. Because of that, you cannot share session in memory. But what you can do is you can certainly share session and application state if you have that existing outside of your ASP application. So if I have a database where I'm storing my session, I can certainly have ASP.NET and ASP communicate with one another using a kind of a hub and spoke model. I'll delve more into that later on. So let's examine now, we've identified some of the integration topics. Now let's talk about a little bit of migration strategies. What I'm going to do here is kind of identify at a high level, 30,000 feet, the different migration strategies you can take. Then I'm going to tell you which way you should go and give you recommendations on what you should do, whether you want to do something tactical or strategic. And then once I establish the directions that you can choose, I'll drill down and I'll identify pros and cons of each direction. And that way, by the end of that section, in about 15 minutes or so, you should have a good understanding of the pros and cons and be able to kind of have a better idea of what's going to make sense for you and your team. So let's look at this slide here. If you look at it on the right-hand side, you see the traditional logical layers, presentation, business, /service, and data. So your presentation layer is where your ASP or ASP.NET code will go, where you might have some JavaScript functions. If you have some smart client activity going on, that's where you would have your smart client logic on the desktop. The business layer is also known as the application or services layer. You can have your DLLs in that layer. you would have your web services in that layer, and certainly any type of server-side logic. And then the data access layer being your stored procedures and DLLs that allow you to get into the database. So that those are the horizontal approaches. So when I talk about a horizontal migration, I mean migrating the presentation layer only or the business layer only. When you look at it, the orange box looking down for the vertical migration, that's one or affecting one or many layers. So this is just a way to give you a definition of what I'm going to be drilling down into, the different types of horizontal and vertical migrations. So in order to determine which way you should go, first you have to identify, do I want a strategic solution or do I want a tactical solution? And of course you're going to say to yourself, well wait, I want strategic, that sounds so much better. That's not necessarily the case. Keep in mind, tactical is not an end, the end. A tactical is often part one of a two-phased approach. So first you're tactical, you start off with doing some tactical things because of constraints on your budget or time or your developer expertise. And then part two would be to finally add to that and finish off and end up ultimately with a strategic. And I'll show you how to do that two-phase migration as we get a little deeper into the choices. So let's talk about how you can choose between horizontal and vertical, and I'll provide considerations, advantages, and disadvantages on them. So let's get a little more meat into this now. So tactical approaches. So this is when you have a brand new novice team that knows nothing about .NET, or this is when your user or your customer wants the application rolled out very, very, very quickly and you don't have a lot of time, or this is when you just don't have enough budget or some other constraint that's preventing you from spending a lot of time doing this. This can be an iterative approach, so you can do many tactical implementations to ultimately end up with a strategic one. The first one, I make this the first one because this is also the most common one. It's what I call the facing. The facing being, I borrow that term from when hackers hack a site and they take off the user interface and replace it with something that they've created. So the facing is just migrating the user interface, which would be a horizontal migration. This happens all the time when you come from ASP to ASP.NET. I've worked on many, many projects where we had to actually go in and save the code because of things that happened with not understanding the implications of doing a defacing migration. So one reason why people like to do it is, okay, well, there's so many great features in ASP.NET 2.0. I want to take advantage of master pages. I want to take advantage of server-side data binding. And I know my team is going to be highly benefit from bringing that classic ASP code, which had all this move first, move next, and iterative logic to create the user interface. They'll benefit highly from bringing this to ASP 2.0. The problem with this is most projects aren't capable of having a clean user interface, meaning there's a lot of create object calls, there's a lot of if-then statements or validation logic going on, there's a lot of business rules mixed into that user interface. When that happens, little do you know, all of a sudden you're knee-deep in the project and you find out that, I guess we have to start migrating some of the DLLs too. Oh, I guess we need to figure out what these business rules are and let's go back to the user requirements. And all of a sudden your project that you thought was a simple UI replacement turns into a vertical migration where you're migrating a whole subsystem. You're migrating the UI, you're migrating the business layer, and then all of a sudden you find that you have to rewrite a stored procedure or two to return a data type that wasn't needed in COM. So that's why, in order to avoid that, I'm going to give you some tips on what you can do to take a look at your code. One thing you can do to look at your code today to determine whether defacing is appropriate for you, grab your ASP file that's your biggest, nastiest ASP file with all kinds of logic in there, the one that's been checked in and out of source safe a million times, the one that has either bottlenecks or problems, whatever it is. It's the easiest way to figure it out is if it's usually the longest and the largest file. Look at that file and then start counting. Start counting how many create object calls you have on that page. Create object calls, meaning that you're calling a business layer. If you start seeing that you have more than four or five create object calls, well, most likely that page is going to have a good amount of spaghetti code business logic in there. If you also start seeing select cases, or if you start using if-then logic and validation logic. And I'm not talking just simple validation where you're checking to see if it's Social Security, but I mean business validation to query against the database. If user exists in database, then allow them to enter it type of thing. If you start seeing that, then you're probably not in a good place to do a defacing migration because it's not going to be as simple as you assume it to be. The reason being is, A, your create object calls, even if you don't have to migrate them to the actual objects to .NET, what you're going to be forced to do is interoperate with them through COM. And what that does is adds an extra layer of abstraction, which I'll talk about in a little bit. But it's going to add a little layer of abstraction to your code and slow down performance a little bit. And it could be a lot depending on how many create object calls that you have. There's ways to improve this and improve performance of this, and I talk about performance in part two. But just keep in mind, if you have a lot of business logic going on, you may want to think twice about doing a simple defacing. It might not be considered a simple front-end rewrite. It might be a little more involved than that. The other tactical approach that may work if you're short on time is a business unit migration. And this is just, again, this is a horizontal migration where you're just migrating a simple business process. A lot of times, this doesn't even involve ASP at all. A lot of times, this might just be a simple DLL. Because when you're doing ASP work, most of you aren't going directly to the database. Most of you probably have a middle tier in place. And when you do a migration from ASP to ASP.NET, you have to think about that middle tier, too. So in this case, you may want to consider just migrating a business process such as customer retrieves and migrate that only and have that in place to get back to your DLLs. Or you might just go ahead and update a single page that just does my customer retrieves. A read-only candidate is an ideal candidate for a migration. A read-only page most likely isn't doing validation, right? Because it's not going back to the database to update anything. A read-only page can also take very good advantage of the server-side binding that we have in place in ASP 1.1 and 2.0. So this is a good candidate for you to take a look at, migrating over read-only non-transactional logic. Another thing you can do today is to set the stage for a full migration to ASP.NET. Again, this is tactical, so you're not fully migrating everything over or being strategic quite yet, but this is a good part one. What you could do is, let's say you have a DLL that is, again, let's use your customer example. It does add, new, delete, update, and retrieve customers. What you can do is take that DLL, let's say it's written in BB6. You can go ahead and write a .NET DLL that's called, customer logic or whatever you want to call it, and reference inside of that the COM DLL. So you'll have an interface now in managed code in .NET that says add new, update, delete, retrieve. This is all .NET, right? Secretly inside, it's actually going to that COM component. The reason why you would do this is, let's say someone that wrote that BB6 component has long left the company. You know the code works, but you don't know what it does, and you don't have the time to sit there and figure it out. But you do want to get to a place where you're going to be strategically migrating to .NET. What you can do is part one of your migration phase is wrap that code up, put the interface, the managed interface, on that code. Then, when you are ready to migrate to ASP.NET, all the ASP.NET code is going to be doing is be calling that .NET interface, right? But secretly, it's going to COM. You avoid that whole doing the interop thing, and the ASP code, ASP.NET code, will not have to change because you're dealing with the .NET interface. Then later, when you're ready, when you have time, you can take out the guts of that .NET assembly and replace the COM logic with proper .NET logic. And that's where you can do a two-phased approach by wrapping your components in .NET. Now let's talk about strategic approaches. Strategic approaches are ideally your ultimate goal, and you definitely want to know about these even if you don't have time and budget right now, because what you could do is layer together a bunch of tactical phases to get to a final strategic phase. So let's talk about what these are. A business unit migration. This is migrating a whole business unit. So this would be all my invoicing, all my customer logic, all my analytics, and you migrate that across multiple layers, whether it's just the UI in business or whether it's all three layers. Another one would be application infrastructure. This one's a tricky one. And I've seen a lot of people do this, thinking that they can take advantage of some features in .NET. What this means is looking at your core components, basically the skeleton of your application, maybe data access or networking or security or authentication. And what they do is they'll see something, and the development teams will see something in .NET 2.0 that they really like. For example, we have a nice membership API now that allows you to manage security and access control lists. So they'll really like that, and they want to use that. And what they'll do is they'll say, okay, let's just go ahead and migrate our security layer. Let's migrate that over into .NET and take advantage of some of the new object models and get rid of all this messy code that we have and have a nice, cleaner assembly. And that's a good reason to do it. The reason why I said this is tricky is because if I take a core component, just the fact that it's called a core component, what does that mean? It means a lot of other components are dependent on it. So when I go ahead and migrate that over, let's say I take my security BB6 DLL and make it a .NET 2.0 DLL and get that ready for my web pages to consume, if I change the program ID for some reason, or if I'm using compiled code to reference it with a hard reference, all that code is going to have to point to that new DLL. So what you can do to avoid that is keep the prog ID the same. So you know when you do a create object call, it's just quotation marks, right? So in ASP. So if you keep the same name, that would probably make your ASP pages play nicely with it. If you're moving two layers from ASP to ASP.NET and the migration in the middle tier, then you don't have to necessarily worry about that. But just realize that if you're working at the core component, all your libraries are going to have to point to that new core. One of my favorite one is this third one, which is what I call an engine infrastructure. This is a fun one. I've seen a lot of success with this in terms of customer projects and projects that I've worked on. What this means is you identify something that has the word engine in your system. This could be reporting engine or a search engine or a workflow engine. The reason why this works so nicely is the engine is usually something that may have problems, right? We always know engine failures, etc. Reporting could cause bottlenecks, searches could be slow, workflows could be inefficient. So they oftentimes have problems after they've matured quite a bit. Another thing is engines oftentimes can be seen very fairly decoupled from the rest of your system. So a search engine, we can design an architecture for a search engine to survive without the rest of the core application business logic. I could put a search engine alongside my system and not have to necessarily rely on touching the actual business logic and the rest of the core mission critical part of the system. Why that's good is if I go ahead and upgrade that to .NET, A, I'm probably going to solve a lot of problems that I had with either performance or bottlenecks or any types of inefficiencies, so that's good, it'll impress your boss. Two is I could probably just migrate that alone because it's fairly decoupled and run that functionality side by side. Another good pointer to point out to you about this is that a lot of times you might not even have an engine. You might not even have a search engine, but you have all your users clamoring for one. They go, oh, when are we going to get a search? When are we going to get a search? We want to be able to do search. Or what if they say, we want to be able to do ad hoc reporting, and you don't have a reporting structure in place. It's a good time to experiment with .NET to put something that is a bell or a whistle or a new feature on there without impacting your production mission critical part of your system. So a good way to get your developers trained up and geared up on .NET, and a good way to either fix existing inefficient functionality or add new functionality and take advantage of the productivity improvements that we have with .NET. So this is, I want to put like a little asterisk by this and start this as a really good candidate for you to take a look at. And then the last one is a full migration, meaning everything. Bring my user interface, my business, everything all up to .NET and ASP.NET. We have some tools for this. Specifically, Visual Studio has migration tools inside of it. We also have an ASP to ASP.NET migration tool. This is specifically for ASP 1.1. I'll point that out. and I'll be covering those tools in part two. So we have tools, but I want to tell you that, as I said in the very first statement of this presentation, is these are two completely different worlds. So a tool could kickstart you, but it's certainly not going to give you the 100% migration that you are finally going to end up with. Is you're going to have some manual intervention necessary to do this rehaul. So let's just wrapping up. So we covered vertical migration, we covered horizontal migration, we covered tactical and strategic approaches. So at this point, you should have a good understanding of all the different approaches you can take, as well as the pros and cons of each one. So now what I want to do is just spend a little bit of time about just getting started and digging a little bit deeper and specifically talking to those of you that are brand new to .NET. So spend a little bit of time talking about some other things you can do while you're doing the migration to keep in mind. And even if you're not new to .NET, these are things you should be thinking about anyway if you're not already. So we'll talk a little bit about that. And then I'll go deeper into migration strategies on how do you know which one of these strategies to choose. So for those of you that are doing the migration strategy now and you're coming to decide on an enterprise architecture for .NET, one thing you need to do up front, this is before you write a line of code, is determine your namespace strategy. I've seen a lot of projects spin wheels mid-cycle trying to redefine their namespaces or when they've already begun development. So if you can, identify this up front. Namespaces are basically .NET's way of identifying the components and assemblies of your system. What a good practice would be, and I see a lot of customers do this, they'll have, let's say I have a security DLL that I wrote, and that I'm going to write in .NET. I'm going to migrate my DB6 logic up. What I can do is I can have a namespace that says my company dot department dot security. If I know that security is going to be consumed at the enterprise level, I might say my company dot security, so it's exposed at a higher level. For ASP.NET components, let's say I have a user control that I build. A lot of companies I've seen them do company name dot department dot web dot whatever the user control name is. The guideline is you can roughly follow what Microsoft uses, what we use as our namespaces. So we have system.web for all our web components. We have system.networking, system.security, etc. So if you just replace system with your company name and your department name, you'll probably be in a good place to have a good namespace and strategy in place. And then once you have it, try not to change it, because it's like in the old days with VB6 and COM, where if you just rename the user, the prog ID, and change a class ID, all the other developers would have to repoint to that. So you want to try to avoid that. Another thing to take a look at is the enterprise library that we have available. You can go ahead and do a search on this, and I think I have references on my part two of my presentation to the actual URL. But you can go ahead and download the enterprise library. These are free components that are code blocks and also white papers to go alongside these code blocks for such features as user interface processing or security or data access or offline access or smart client, etc. So if you're thinking about any of these things that you see listed on Enterprise Library, it may behoove you to just go ahead and download that block, take a look at it. If you want to use it wholesale, go ahead and use it as is. It's all object-oriented, of course. So if you want to, you can go ahead and extend that or take bits and pieces. One warning I'll tell you, and I've seen this actually happen with some projects I worked on, is people will get, block crazy, and they'll download them all. They'll have like 50,000, not that many, we don't have that many, but they'll download a bunch of these application building blocks and reference them in their projects. And then they never use them, or if they do, they use like one method. Now they have like 400K of memory in DLLs loaded in their application. Then every user that calls that web application is going to hit that memory. So if you're not going to use them, don't just stick them in your project just gratuitously. Think about if you're going to use them. If you want to use bits and pieces of them, you might want to streamline them and create your own version of the enterprise library. Other things to think about while you're doing the migration is your bridging strategy. ASP.NET is also the system.web is also part of the strategy that we have for web services. So you can go ahead and write a method, and all you have to do is tag it with a web method attribute, and all of a sudden it's available through HTTP. So what you can be doing is, especially when you're doing ASP to ASP.NET migration, is you're probably going to be hitting on some shared components that you might want to think about whether other systems or other users could benefit from. So instead of just going ahead and migrating that COM code into a .NET assembly, you may want to think about making that a web service in addition. A good candidate for a web service would be something that involves the word cross, like if you're crossing a firewall or if you're crossing a language, like say J2E needs to communicate with your logic, that's a good candidate for making a web service. And another thing that you can do up front while you're determining your migration strategy, I'm imagining that you're going to be putting together this document, right, this Word document that says our migration strategy and proposal, whatever it is. Something to include in that document would be your language strategy, whether you're going to use VB, .NET, C#, or C++, or a mix of these. You can use all of these and mix them all together, any of the .NET 26 or so .NET languages. What I see a lot of the larger customers do is just pick one or two. The nuances between these are so small that if you want to talk about whether should I choose one or another, that's better suited for another discussion. But it's safe to say there's a lot of guidance on helping you choose between one or the other. Most companies will choose VB.NET or C# or both. Okay, now let's go a little deeper. Now that we've identified and set the stage on what you need to do to get ready, let's go in a little bit about analyzing your current system and applying the appropriate solution for your needs. And then once we do the analysis, we'll be ready to start talking about implementation, which is the part two. All right, so we already talked about the horizontal and vertical and what they are. Now let's determine how you choose what's appropriate for you, whether it's horizontal or vertical. The best way to do this is look at the cons. Look at the pros and look at the cons, but really look at the cons, okay? When you start seeing a lot of cons that you know will have serious repercussions within your organization, that's probably not the strategy for you. So again, the best way to choose a migration strategy is to eliminate the ones that are not right for you. And then the ones that are left is probably the ones that are going to be right for you. Usually it's a mix of several different strategies. So I covered up some of these earlier and gave you some of the pros and cons. So in that case, I'll just whip through those, and you'll have these as reference material. And there's some that I actually didn't get into detail yet, so I'll cover those in greater detail. So this next section of the presentation, what I do is I talk about what this is. So this is more for your reference. And then I talk about why you should do it. And then I talk about caveats on that, like things to consider. So we already decided, we already identified pretty much what is defacing. We didn't really talk about why you'd want to do it besides the fact that ASP.NET may have some features for you. Usually why people do this is for server-side binding. In order to do, let's say I want to put together a table, an HTML-based table based on data I have from the records in the database. What I have to do in ASP is use the record set. When I use the record set, I have to do, EOF and BOF is false, move first, move next, etc., and I have to write this looping construct. What you can do is take a look at your pages today. See if you have a lot of that logic. Look for move first statements or move next statements. If you see a lot of that logic on a page, and if the page is mostly composed of that kind of looping construct, you are in a great place to think about using ASP.NET for server-side control binding. We have this feature available in all versions of ASP.NET, whether you're using 1.0, 1.1, or 2.0. So you will be in a good place if you start seeing a lot of move first, move next, because all that code that you had in there is probably about, 12 lines of code, not including the error handling. That's now going to be 3 lines of code. And that's going to be propagated every single time that you need to build an HTML table. The other reason why people choose to do a defacing approach is because that you have multiple compiled languages. Compiled, I put asterisks by that, because what that means is it runs faster. It's not interpreted like ASP is. So you're going to get a performance boost just from moving from ASP to ASP.NET. You could even mix languages. I don't necessarily recommend that because your developers will probably go nuts, but you could have 4 different languages going on in ASP.NET or 26 at the most if you wanted to. Most companies just choose one. And then you can go ahead and use user controls, which actually gives you a way to encapsulate your code in as almost like pseudo class files. And speaking of user controls, another thing that you can take advantage of, which is going to be a learning curve for those of you that have only worked in ASP and have little exposure to object-oriented programming, is the concept of code files. So in ASP.NET, what you have is a class that sits behind your ASP, your server-side code. And that class will contain your event handling, like your button clicks or whatnot. It will contain any components and controls that you create as an object-oriented language. You didn't have that. What you had to do before, you executed the code from top to bottom, and it would be a nice, lovely mix of messy mix of server-side and ASP code and HTML code. So one thing that you can do up front before, if you're brand new to ASP.NET and you don't have an object-oriented background, learn the basics of object orientation, because that's what ASP.NET is. Another reason why, a couple other reasons why you'd want to do a defacing is better session state management options. In the past, you really just would have to build your own session state management if you wanted to extend what ASP had. In ASP.NET, you have the ability to go ahead and choose a database. So if you have a web farm and you have like 7 web servers and one of them goes down and you want the user's session to be preserved, it's a good idea to have a database being your back end for session management so that the other servers can pick up the session from a database rather than the actual box that went down, because you won't be able to get it if it's down, right? Another great feature that I can't recommend more highly is caching. If you're not using this today in ASP.NET, use it. And for those of you that haven't migrated yet, really think about where you can apply caching. Caching is really simple to implement. You can just put a tag at the page directive and cache the entire page, or you can cache fragments of your page. So let's say I have a drop-down box that has country names, or countries change too much. Let's do cities that don't change that often. I know they come from the database, but you know what? I know that we have 50 states. We've had 50 states for a while. Let's cache that data and only refresh it, once a year. All you have to do is put 2 tags, a start and end tag, around that drop-down list, and that component will automatically be cached for you. And you can set an expiration on that. You can even get more advanced in ASP 2.0 with SQL Server 2005, is you can actually have SQL Server 2005 automatically refresh the cache for you anytime that the data in the database changes. So you don't even have to do anything yourself. So you don't have to make arbitrary guesses on when you should expire your cache. Another big reason why people choose defacing is because of better server-side event handling. So in the past, it was kind of clumsy for you to put some event code in a button click. You'd have to do these postbacks and then capture the data and understand that. Whereas in ASP.NET 2.0 and 1.1, it works very similar to building a desktop application. In development mode, I go ahead and click on a button, double-click on it, and I go to the code behind it, and I can go ahead and write my logic for server-side event handling. That being said, it is very important that you understand the object lifecycle for ASP.NET pages. They have a load and unload, etc. You never had to worry about that before, but you have to actually think about that now. I've seen a lot of people make mistakes where they put a lot of code in the page load event to, let's say, initialize database connections and whatnot, thinking that's the first event to fire when it's actually the page init that fires, and then later they try to access that code in something that happens in the initialize phase, but that load hasn't fired yet, so none of their connections are initialized, and then they end up having problems, especially if they have pages that inherit from one another. So I can't tell you how important it is to know the event lifecycle, and I have a slide to highlight that for you. Other things, I talked about faster performance, and I also talked about the bridging strategy. Okay, so things that you should go and think about. I told you, make sure you analyze your code up front before you do the defacing, so you know that what your extent of business logic. I talked about the weak typing and strong typing. What I didn't talk about is on your web servers, you'll have to actually deploy the .NET runtime if you don't already have it in place, especially if you have an ASP web server only and you don't have ASP.NET. You have to make sure that you actually have the .NET framework on there. That's something you can do in advance before you even actually go ahead and roll that out. And if you're using MTS or Complus or Enterprise Services, you'll have to configure ASP.NET impersonation to enable role-based security. I actually get into more detail about that in part two. So now let's talk about business modular. We identify what that is in terms of, you know, replacing something in the middle tier. Considerations about that I talked about a little bit is COM interrupt, just having a little bit of layer of abstraction. Another reason why you want to be careful if you want to migrate just a middle tier component, let's say I choose one, like I said, my security one, and every single thing is calling security, and it's really tightly coupled to all the other components, you might want to be just careful about migrating that over, knowing that it has so many dependencies. And I talked about earlier is maintaining the component names so you don't have to rewrite the web tier. And then lastly, what I didn't talk about, which applies to anything that's involving the middle tier, is in ASP and COM, you used record sets. In ADO.NET, you're going to be using data sets. There are two different things. In part two, I give you actual code snippets on how you convert from one to the other, but I'm just giving you these as kind of things that you can count off on your fingers as things to be concerned about. Wrapping, I talked about as well in terms of what that is, wrapping your COM components with a .NET interface so that you don't have to rewrite your .NET code when it talks to your interface. In part one of this wrapping phase, when you just have the COM logic, again, you're still using COM interop, so you're not going to be able to take advantage of some of the .NET features, such as parameterized constructors or something that hasn't been invented yet in COM. But the beauty of this, though, is that in part two, you'll get rid of that whole interoperability layer. Another reason why you wouldn't want to do this, let's say I have, let me think of a good example. Let's say I have a search, and I decide I take my COM component that's a search engine, and I migrate it to .NET, and I give it a search interface. Everything calls search, right? Let's just say everything's calling that search engine, and that's the way I architected my system, and it's very, very chatty. Every single time we call that search, it's going through COM interop. So if you have a really, really chatty component that's talking to a lot of things, probably not the best candidate for a wrapping. You want to do something that's fairly not talking so much to other components. And it's also a good idea to do something that really has complicated logic inside or it runs for a really long time. Just some reason why you decided not to migrate it to .NET. Just find some kind of validation for that. And then again, the threading model between COM and .NET is different. And there's things you can do to avoid the performance hit between switching from MTA to STA. .NET uses a multi-threaded where the apartment model applies for the single-threaded apartments apply for the COM layer. I give you tips and tricks in part two on what you can do with your code to avoid this performance dip, but again, just something that you should be aware of. Vertical migration, we identify what that was. That was basically doing a whole system unit. Let's just say it's your customer logic or your invoicing logic, etc. Things to why you would do that is, again, there's something in .NET that you really would want to take advantage of, whether it's a building block or whether it's just taking advantage of the improved garbage collection and memory management, the self-healing capabilities of .NET, or any other feature in .NET, which is a great reason to do this. Another reason to do this, again, with the performance, is improving your performance and getting faster performance with .NET. One of the slides that I have in here that you can actually pull down from the case study online is just an increase in performance. If you have ASP and COM Plus, just taking the pages served per second and just migrating that up to .NET will get you much more faster throughput on your pages. All right, so that pretty much covers all the identifications and what why you need to do things. So we covered the what, we covered the why, and now let's talk about some analysis. We're just going to spend a little bit of time on analysis, and then I'm going to stop and take a question and answer. I see I have a nice queue already built up. So for those of you that haven't already asked questions and have any, just go ahead and feel free to ask them in the live meeting console. All right, so now that you have decided, let's just say you chewed on that, you decided what you want to do, I want to do X migration. Now, how do you know what goes where and what code to move and how to do this? A couple techniques on identifying how to move your components, now that you identified why and what, is doing code path analysis. This allows you to identify your system dependencies. You can use a tool for this, so you can do this by hand if you want. Usually the architect will have a good idea of this, so a lot of times it just requires a nice sit-down meeting to identify the dependencies. And I'll talk about this in a little bit more detail. And then identifying your infrastructure of your application, like where data access is, where security is stored, if you're deciding to migrate any of that core logic to .NET. Because even if you're doing a simple defacing where you're just replacing the UI, you still need to be considerate of security and caching and whatnot. Because, for example, caching, you might have had some crazy caching logic put together in VB6 that becomes irrelevant because of ASP.NET. So you still need to identify these infrastructures and what you're doing and determine whether there is an analogous feature in ASP.NET or the .NET framework that serves your needs. Especially also with security. Authentication in ASP.NET has greatly made a lot of improvements, especially in ASP 2.0. So you want to make sure you understand all these core components that are available and then determine if it's appropriate for you to migrate your code at that time. My favorite way to analyze the application is just look at the pages that are read-only, the ones that have HTML tables on them that bring back some data. Let's say you have page data, like 1 to 100, 101 to 200, etc. That's a fantastic candidate for ASP.NET because we have great improvements with caching and paging. We have, again, I talked about server-side binding. But besides that, besides all our new features, the best advantage is the fact that it's easy, right? Because there's no business logic. I mean, there probably shouldn't be business logic in a read-only page, and there's probably no postbacks going on that page. So it's just going to be a great, simple way to get started with migrating your code. And then it's also a good candidate. Also, read-only code is a same strategy that I recommend to people for web services. People that are brand new to web services and haven't used them before, they say, okay, how do I know what should be a web service? Besides the whole cross thing that I told you about earlier, read-only data. That's a great candidate for a web service. If you're unsure of how to use web services or not quite ready to put the security in place, well, by all means, don't be allowing people to update your database. Just do read-only instead. Okay, so code path analysis, what this is. Again, you can use a tool if you want to, or you can just do this by hand. All it is mapping out. Now that you identified what you're doing, now you have to go ahead and map out your system to determine what your dependencies are. And then you can figure out exactly what pieces of code need to migrate. So, for example, I have an ASP application. Let's look at the one on the right side. I have a page, and, you know, it's my customer. I decided to do read-only logic, and I'm going to bring back customer data. Let me see, when I hit that button, get customer data, when the user hits that button on the UI, what happens? In this case, it goes to a DLL. And only one DLL. It goes to a customer DLL, and let's say that goes to an XML file. It doesn't even go to a database. That's it. Well, that's probably a good candidate to migrate. And that's now I've identified exactly what code needs to change. I can write that up and hand that to the development team, and now they're set to go. Or let's look on the left-hand side. Let's say it's the same scenario. I have a customer logic that I want to bring back in read-only format. I hit the button. I go ahead and see what that button click event does. I go track it, and I see that, okay, well, it's first calling this XML parser to take the XML that was sent up and parse it into a binary record set. Okay. Then it goes to record set parser. What's this? Okay, I didn't even realize we had that DLL. Okay. And then, oh, it's going through a validator. That's weird. I don't know why we're validating on read-only, but okay, that's the case. Oh, and then it goes to the customer access DS. So then all of a sudden you realize it hit four DLLs. And all these DLLs now, if you go ahead and let's migrate your page from ASP.NET to ASP, you're going to have to think about whether you want any of these DLLs to be migrated as well. Let's say it's quite chatty between these, and you decide to migrate that first one and hits that XML one, because you say to yourself, well, we don't need that XML parser anymore, because the data set is automatically XML, right? So why do I need this parser? So you get rid of that. Then all of a sudden you realize that's talking to the second component, and then you realize that should be migrated to .NET. And all of a sudden you have middle tier that you're implementing instead of just one DLL on a single page. So that's why code analysis is really important, so you identify your dependencies. And sometimes it's surprising, because especially if your project's been around for quite some time and people have been organically adding to it, you might not even know what objects are being used. All right, so now that we did the analysis, the last part of it is type what where, and that's not what we're going to cover today because there's just so many things to cover. But I did want to leave you with a little bit of implementation for those of you that are code hungry and looking for type what where. Realize we'll definitely cover this. We'll spend the entire session on covering the code tips in part two. But things you can do today is in your code in ASP today and VB6 today, use option explicit making sure that your types are strongly typed in VB6 or your middle tier. In ASP.NET, you have the other advantage of actually bringing that to your web tier. And we actually extend that with option strict in addition to option explicit, which means that I actually have to make sure when I'm assigning data to that variable, let's say I have an integer, option strict says, well, I'll get a compiler error in design mode if I try to give a string to an integer type, so make sure that they're the exact right type. Another thing to avoid, and again, all these things I'm going to get deeper in with code in part two, but I just want to give you something, is avoiding default properties. That's something that we had available in the past, which is no longer available in ASP 2.0 and 1.1, is let's say I have a text box called Osley's text box. Before, I was able to get the text out of that text box by saying my variable equals Osley text box, and it knew that the default property was the text property, and I can get the value in that text box. Now you actually have to explicitly say Osley's text box dot text. So if you can in your ASP code, just make that extra step and start using default properties. It's a good practice so you can be ready for ASP.NET 2.0. And it's just a good practice, so it makes your migration a lot easier. When you're doing calls for subroutines and functions, use parentheses and call, because that's what's required in ASP.NET. Another tip I can tell you is, I'm sure you're using include files probably all over the place. What most likely is going to happen in ASP.NET is those include files are going to turn into classes that sit behind your ASP.NET pages. So if you can, try untangling them a little bit and flatten them out, and if you can, just kind of make them a little more logically oriented. And let's say you have a bunch of utilities. Put them all in one file, so when you migrate that, most likely it's going to be a class called utility.whatever, and that'll just make it a lot easier for your migration rather than you having to sit there and decipher, okay, wait, this include file calls this include file, but it calls it then. Okay, so this, okay, and this didn't execute yet, and it'll just be much easier for you than having to sit there and figure that out on top of doing the migration. Likewise, for your little DLLs, try to, and your JavaScript utilities, try to group them as well in logical fashion. A, you'll find out a lot of these you don't have to do anymore in ASP.NET 2.0, and B, it'll just make it easier if you still need to do them that you have them all set up as class libraries in a logical format. Other things to do now is, if you can, separate your HTML content away from the rest of your code. I get more into this where I specifically talk about rendering your code. Use a response that write rather than just sticking raw chunks of HTML in your code. We'll cover that in detail in part two, as well as using the script block rather than the percentage block, so that's easily transferable to ASP.NET. Even though we have a garbage collector in ASP.NET, still you don't know when that garbage collector has just come around, so always use the close statement for your stateful resources, such as your record sets and your connections. It's still a good practice in ASP.NET 2.0. And another thing that we no longer support in ASP, whether it's 1.1 or 2.0, is mixed languages. So a lot of people, this happens when, let's say you go to the web and you search for some kind of function that you need, and then you find out that it's been written in JScript and you guys use VBScript, and then you just copy-paste it and shove it into your code and you forget to convert it. So I've seen a lot of work where you have VBScript and JScript on a single page. We supported that before. We no longer support that anymore. And even if you are using it now, stop using it, because what you're forcing the browser to do is load two different scripting runtimes. So you're increasing the memory on the browser just by, not taking the time to go ahead and convert it to a single language, whether it's JScript or VBScript. And then the last thing I want to talk about just briefly, and I'll cover more in part two, is some of the features we have in 2.0 that are brand new that you can think about today. Is one thing is master pages. This, I'm not going to go into detail about 2.0. This is not the time for it, but I do want to point this out because it's important for your migration strategy. When you're looking at your ASP pages and you're determining what to migrate over to ASP.NET 2.0, also take a look at the layout and infrastructure information architecture of your pages. Start looking for common denominators. Let's say I see often that I use a three-column layout. Or let's say I know that my pages have certain elements on them when they're an intranet page versus an extranet page. These will be good candidates for master pages, which serve very similar to how a Word doc template works, where I have a template for a Word document. It's the same idea where you have a template for your web pages. Another thing to decide before you even write a line of code is who's going to be the master of your master pages. It's a very similar dilemma that we faced back when cascading style sheets were invented. When if I decide to take my cascading style sheet and change my font from 12 to 17, every single page that used that cascading style sheet now was affected, and then probably negatively. The same thing exists for master pages. So anything that inherits from a master page is going to get that same change. So determine where you're going to store your master pages, and also determine who's going to be responsible for version control to make sure that they don't negatively affect any page that's dependent on that master pages. Another new feature we have is web parts. A good way to start looking for web partable components on your ASP pages is look for things that are reused more than once. That's a good candidate for a web part. Also look for things, pages that look kind of like a digital dashboard, where you want your users to be able to kind of manipulate the page and personalize it and bring components, let's say, you saw this on any portal, like where you have my stock ticker over here, my weather over there, and then the user can move them around, and the next time they log in, it stays the same way that they left it last time. That's what web parts are. So this is something you can do by printing out your schematics of your page and identifying what's going to be a web part. And then security model I talked about a little briefly with the membership API. If you already have your own security built into place, take a good look at something called the membership and role API that's new to ASP.NET 2.0. This might be something that will replace a lot of messy code that you had in the past. And I already talked about the enterprise library. So I'm running over by 5 minutes, but that's okay because we are wrapping up. So what we covered so far was migration strategy. We identified all the what. We then talked about all the pros and cons about each one. So you got a good idea of what you could do and why you should do it. Talked about what's tactical and what's strategic and how you can get from one to the other. And then I provide a little bit of tips on analyzing your code, so what you could do to figure out what components need to be migrated. And then what you can do to get started now, we just covered that briefly. It's just kind of a prelude to the deeper session we're going to have on Monday. Just keep in mind, Monday's session is going to be pretty developer-friendly. So those of you out there that are more project manager or high-level people that aren't familiar with development may kind of start glazing over. So this was an appropriate session for all audiences, where next on Monday it's going to be better for just if you're a developer. But I mean, I welcome everybody to come, of course. So specifically in part two, we'll be covering doing the migration. The way I put together the presentation is, here's a scenario that may affect you. This is how you did it in ASP. This is how you should do it in ASP.NET. And you can actually copy-paste that code and bring it into your own work. I also provide other tips that I personally came across doing many different migrations over the last few years. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to start looking at the Q&A, and while I'm doing that, Jeff is going to take the line and talk about the survey, which will be on your screens. So answer the survey so you can win the prize, or register, not win the prize, but get in the raffle to win the prize. And your feedback is valuable to us, so any comments you want to add are great, especially because I'm doing part two, and then if you want to add comments for part two, I'll definitely take them into consideration. So at this point, I'm going to hand over to Jeff. I'm going to look over the Q&A, and then Jeff, when you're done your part, you can hand over to me, and I'll answer the questions and answers.
Okay, great. Thank you, Osley. Yeah, I'd like to take a minute here to share some additional resources. And we have lots of questions, but just in case you haven't had a chance to get one in and you're not sure, you can always ask a question by typing your question into the field next to the Ask button in the Question Manager, and then just simply click Ask. And as Osley mentioned, we'll be providing a survey for today's event in just a moment. When you see that, please, again, take a few moments to complete the survey. Feedback and comments that you provide will allow us to create better webcasts for you in the future. So your feedback is greatly appreciated. If I got a couple of URLs here I'd like to give out. If you are interested in any upcoming or previously live webcasts, there's a URL for you to follow. If you have webcast content ideas, perhaps you'd like to see specific content developed for a future webcast, there's a URL for you to visit. And of course, today's webcast was presented using Microsoft Office Live Meeting, and you can go here to download a free 14-day trial. And by filling out the webcast evaluation that we'll have up in a moment, you're automatically entered to win this 40-gigabyte Creative Zen Ultra MP3 player. It's pretty cool. And here is the web evaluation. Please follow the links provided in the interface, and again, take a few moments to complete today's webcast evaluation. And there's plenty of questions, so with that, I will hand it back to Osley to start looking into those.
Okay, so I have a lot of questions. I'm going to stay on the line and answer as many as I can. If you have to leave for some reason and I don't get to your question or you don't hear it, the session is going to be recorded. I'll try to cover them all. Some of them are longer, so probably better suited for email. If I don't get to your question, or if your question is really complicated, email me at aslib@microsoft.com. So let's go ahead and start with some of these questions, and hopefully I'll try to ask ones that I know that are more popular so I can hit up like a couple people at the same time. Okay, so let's see. I don't even know where to begin. Okay. Let's do this one. Okay, could you direct us to some resources for migrating from VB6? Okay, the question is, can I have some more information on migrating VB6 apps to ASP 2.0? I can email you some resources, but if you do a simple search on a web search, you can definitely find a lot of material on VB6 to .NET migration. Don't say ASP.NET in your search, just say .NET, and that'll get you better resources. We actually have a whole sub-site dedicated to that. Just type in quotes VB6 migration, and that'll get you what you need. But I can give you some samples, tips right now. In Visual Studio, in 2003 and 2005 versions, if you take a VB6 project, so a VBG file or a VBP file, and you do File Open, it will automatically launch the migration wizard for you. And what that does, it takes your VB6 code, your project, and brings it up into .NET. And then in .NET, once it's there, it'll change all the code to be .NET, and anything that it can't change, it will provide you a hyperlinkable comment right above that line of code that it couldn't change. You click on that hyperlink, and it gives you help on what you should do for that. So, for example, the isAny keyword, that was deprecated in .NET. But isAny could be anything, right? isAny. So the tool is not going to be able to tell you what you should use for that. So instead, it'll give you a comment saying you might want to use system.reflection to figure out this, or you might want to give this a strong data type, etc. So that's one way. And then the second way is in the Visual Studio 2003, we introduced another tool called the Snippet. I don't know what it's called. I think it's the Snippet migration tool. It's under your tools menu. And what it is It's a little notepad-like window that you can actually copy-paste chunks of EB6 code, and it spits out .NET code. And you can consume that .NET code in a DLL or an ASP.NET. It's really helpful, like, say you don't know in .NET how to create a property. You can take an old existing property in VB6, and then it'll automatically slap it into a .NET property for you. So those are just some tips off the top of my head. And then just doing a search on VB6 migration. Also do a search on the name J, J-A-Y, and then R-O-X-E. Put that in quotes. He's our lead for migration efforts. So, all right, so I got a question on sharing session state between classic ASP and ASP.NET. How do you do it? So, all right, a couple things about that. I'm going to cover that in more detail in part two, so I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but what you can do in order to share session state, put your session state somewhere else. Get it off the web server. Get it out of the ASP session memory. You can put it in an XML file. You can put it in a database. You can put it in a comma delimited file. It doesn't matter where you put it, just as long as it's not using the native session state, because ASP.NET doesn't understand that, and ASP doesn't understand ASP.NET. Part two of that question someone asked is like, okay, well, what if I use ASP.NET? It has the ability for me to stick my session state in SQL. Why can't I use that? And then have classic ASP pick that up. Okay, so yes, that is a feature that we have. We have the ability for you to automatically just have session state stored in SQL Server without you having to do anything. The problem for ASP is that it's stored as a binary, and ASP doesn't understand how to read it because it's native to ASP.NET. So what I would recommend is, and I talk about this in part two, is just building your own session management table. It's so easy, you know, just a value key lookup, right? Just building that table yourself and then having ASP and ASP.NET consume that together. And I'll show you the code and tips about that in part two. Okay, let's see what else I have here. I'm not understanding some of these questions, so if I don't answer them, just reiterate them. For example, the domain folder question, could you ask that? I'm not understanding that. Let's see what else. If in a web application, ASP using Commoner uploads the .NET framework, and ASP tries to use the framework which shows an exception. Okay, anything with exception that you're getting, just email me that. How do you separate JScript and VBScript from an ASP? Okay, so you can't really separate it. You just have to choose what language. So the question was, how do I separate JScript and VBScript? In ASP, in classic ASP, we supported both languages on a single page. In ASP.NET, you can only have one. So what my tip was, start switching over now so you don't have to go through that process later, just so you can have a two-step approach. Ultimately, you're going to have to pick one. So you can keep your JScript and VBScript together if you want for ASP forever if you wanted to. It's just that to make it easier to go to ASP.NET, you'll have to decide on which one you're going to use. And a good way to start getting that out of the way is doing it today. All right, so let's see. Someone has a question on ADO migration. I don't know what the question is, but if you want me to give you tips on that, I will cover that in part two. The biggest change being that they are completely, again, two different things. You have data sets and data tables in ASADO. In ASP, you had record sets, which is very similar to a data table. So think of a record set as being a data table, and then I can have one or many data tables inside of a data set. So that being said, though, you're not alone, because we have methods that take a record set and automatically convert it up to a data set for you. So I'll talk about exactly what those methods and objects are when I cover part two. I'll just give you what object it is now because it's easy to say. It's the data adapter object. And look at the fill method of that object to go from a record set to a data set. All right, so someone's asking about having an ASP.NET application to use. They want to use 2.0 output within an ASP page. Okay, so ASP has no clue what ASP.NET is, right? If I try to stick a web form that belongs in ASP.NET in ASP, it's not going to work. ASP is not going to understand that. But in order, you're asking me ideas on how to do this. what you could do is put it into a format that ASP will understand, such as XML or HTML, something that a method could spit out and render and then pass over to ASP and consume it that way. Think of any type of common denominator between the two being like a string or XML, and then just inserting that into that. I'm not sure if you want to follow up with me. I'm not sure what the business reason is for doing that. A better approach is just to have those pages exist side by side rather than trying to have a window of ASP.NET code inside of an ASP page. Just the only other way I can think of that you could do something like that is taking SharePoint Portal Server and using one web part that's ASP, and then another web part that's ASP.NET, and then having that all sit on the same page together. What else? Beginner.NET learning resources. Yes, there are. I can send you resources on that. If you just go to Microsoft.com/Visual Studio or msdn.microsoft.com, there is a lot of resources there, but I'm happy to send you the material that I have. Okay, so what else? Interoperability. Is it possible to pass data from an ASP page to an ASPX page and then hand that data to an ASP page? Yes, you can pass data back and forth between the pages. You can use a common component if you want. You can use a query string if you wanted to. You can use cookies even. The recommendation is probably use a common component, and that way you can add an extra layer of security to it. That's your best way of kind of passing data back and forth. Another option is introducing a database, depending on how complicated that you want to get with that. Okay, so I'm 20 after, so I don't want to keep going. I'll just do two more questions, and then anyone that didn't get answered, just will just send me an email or ask me again in part two if you attend that one. Okay, so question is, how exactly is caching implemented at the control level? Okay, so I talked a little bit about page caching. If I wanted to, I can have every single page cached, and by just having my page declarative saying cache at the page level. To do it at the control level, there's something called fragment caching, F-A-R-A-G-M-E-N-T. All I do is put a start and end tag around my control, and it will have that code, that control data cached. That cache will reside in a specific object called the ASP.NET system cache, and that will sit on the web server. If I want to, I can take it further and cache at the database, but that kind of eliminates the whole point of having caching, right? You don't want to go to the database. That's why you put caching in place. So just take a look at page and fragment caching and take a look at that, and also take a look at state management, which is another similar segue into caching. Look at view state and look up a little bit more on that. And then let's see URLs, they're all in the PowerPoint, so if you want to go ahead and download that one, that's available on the recorded, you'll have that available. And then let's see what else. Tab control for ASP.NET 2.0. We have some tabbing available. And then my email address, someone's asking, is ASLIB, so Apple, Sam, Larry, Igloo, Boy, @Microsoft.com. All right, so I'm going to stop there with the question. I got through a good chunk of them. The ones I didn't get to require me to go into more detail, so just email me or ask me again in a shorter format so I can understand it a little better. So thank you all for your time. Jeff, I'm going to hand back to you. Thanks for hanging out extra overtime. And that's it.
Okay. Well, I would like to extend a special thank you to Osley for presenting today, and especially for hanging in with all those questions. Thanks to everyone for attending today's webcast. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes the MSDN webcast. Thanks again for joining us. You may now disconnect from the audio portion of this conference.